All right, so our gospel story this morning is a very familiar one, the feeding of the 5,000. In the story, Jesus and his disciples are able to feed over 5,000 people, even though they are given only 5 loaves and 2 fish. Now, even if you haven't read this morning's passage from the Gospel of John, you've probably read one of the other versions of the story. It's the only miracle to appear in all 4 Gospels, which means that it was very popular with the early Christian community, and that I think it was very central to their understanding of who Jesus was and is and what he was about. The story was so popular that Matthew and Mark wrote a sequel. The feeding of the 4,000 also appears in both of their Gospels. I know, it seems kind of anticlimactic, right? All it took was one miraculous feeding, and all of a sudden we're jaded. Like, is that all you got, Jesus? You're just feeding 4,000 people now? Really? But something is up here. In only 4 Gospels, we have 6 stories about Jesus feeding huge crowds. So why is this image so important? Well, Matthew, Mark, and Luke all tell a very similar story. Jesus is pursued up the mountain by a crowd of people who are in need of healing. All Jesus wanted to do was have some peace and quiet, but he has compassion on them and he spends his day curing them. By evening, though, the disciples have had enough. They ask Jesus to send the people away to buy food for themselves in the towns. But Jesus says, "You give them something to eat." The disciples are outraged. "All we have are 5 loaves and 2 fish. Unspoken subtext that we were planning to eat ourselves. Jesus takes the food, gives thanks, breaks the bread, and has the disciples give it to the crowd who are seated on the grass around him. And when all is said and done, there are 12 baskets left over. Now, there's something really familiar about the way that Jesus gives thanks and breaks the bread and the way the disciples hand it out to the people. It feels a lot like communion, doesn't it? As if the physical hunger of the people somehow points to their spiritual hunger as well. As if this physical food points to some kind of spiritual food. And there is plenty for everyone. With Jesus, there is actually more than enough to go around. So the story, I think, kind of points forward to communion, to the sacrament of communion that we continue to share in together every week here at Hot Metal. But John actually tells the story a bit differently than the other gospel writers. And I want to listen together now to John's version, and I'm going to ask you to pay close attention to the details. For instance, who is it in John's version that worries that there won't be enough? Who brings the bread and the fish? What kind of loaves are they? And finally, how does the crowd react or respond to this miraculous meal? This is a reading from the Gospel of John, chapter 6, verses 1 through 15. After this, Jesus went to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, also called the Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd kept following him because they saw the signs that he was doing for the sick. Jesus went up the mountain and sat down there with his disciples. And now the Passover, the festival of the Jews, was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a large crowd coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we going to buy bread for all these people?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he was going to do. And Philip answered him, "6 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little." And one of the other disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "Here is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what are they among so many people?" Jesus said, "Make the people sit down." And now there was a great deal of grass in the place, so they sat down, about 5,000 in all. Then Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish, as much as they wanted. When they were satisfied, he told his disciples, "Gather up the fragments left over so that nothing may be lost." So they gather them up, and from the fragments of the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten, they filled 12 baskets. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they began to say, "This is indeed the prophet who has come into the world." When Jesus realized that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, he withdrew again to the mountain by himself. Word of God for the people of God. So first of all, can we just take a minute to show Philip some love? Everybody loves Andrew for being the nice guy who brings the young boy to meet Jesus. But Philip gets all the abuse for being dense and small-minded and faithless. First of all, Jesus set him up. Not cool, Jesus. Not cool. And second of all, Philip is just being realistic, right? I mean, bread costs money. Am I right? Heidi, am I right? Any of y'all who like cook lunch for us on Sundays, does bread cost money? It costs money. So my point is, food ain't free, people, all right? So cut Philip a break. He's just being practical. So in this story, Philip and Andrew make appearances, plus the boy who shows up with the food. And there are some other new details that we don't see in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, like the fact that the loaves are made of barley. Not something that Mark, Matthew, or Luke mention. So why is that important to John? For this question, I consulted Hot Metal's scholar in residence, Dr. Dan Freyer Griggs. You guys all know Dan? He's a smart guy. He knows a lot of things. He's got a PhD in biblical studies. So I'd like to read to you from the official transcript of our Facebook conversation. This is Dan. Most commentators will note that barley was cheaper and easier to come by than sifted wheat, and so it was peasant bread, not the fancy wheat bread of the elites. Here's a nice quote from Philo. Barley is, quote, of somewhat doubtful merit, suited for irrational animals and men in unhappy circumstances. This is me. One thing I like about this friendship is that you can just assume that I will enjoy a quote from an ancient Jew about barley, and you will assume correctly. Since barley loaves were suited for men in unhappy circumstances, we can assume that the boy did not come from a wealthy family. The boy is not sharing out of his abundance. He's sharing out of the little that he has. And in fact, it's likely that many of the people in the crowd were of meager means. There is some archaeological evidence which suggests that a major economic shift was happening in this region around the time of Jesus. The economic center was shifting away from the countryside and towards the cities. And the result was that the agrarian economy that had supported the farmers and their families was being disrupted. Farms were shrinking and people were struggling. In that sense, it was not totally unlike our own time and the economic disruption that is happening in our society, in our culture. Farmers, of course, have struggled for a while now, but also manufacturing jobs, as we well know in Pittsburgh, are a lot harder to come by. Some of us feel that university education seems to sometimes create more economic burdens than it does economic opportunities. The gap between the very rich and the rest of us is expanding. And I think it's fair to say that there's a general feeling of frustration. People are frustrated, and they would totally follow Jesus up a mountain for free healthcare, or maybe even just for the free dinner. Maybe if Bernie Sanders had shuffled up that mountain, hunched himself over a podium, hammered away at the 1% and their sifted wheat, promised to stick it to Wall Street, they would have followed him instead and made him president or king. The point is, the people were ripe for a revolution. And in fact, there had already been other messiahs who had rallied the people. One was an Egyptian prophet who assembled a huge crowd on the Mount of Olives, promised that God would knock down the walls of Jerusalem and that the people would retake the city. Funny thing about that. It turns out that what happens after you say things like that is that the empire comes and kills the crap out of you. So maybe that's why Jesus wasn't too thrilled when the crowd suddenly wanted to play kingmaker. He's like, guys, you are totally missing the point about I'm trying to make with this miracle. So what was the point? Maybe there's more than one point. The common thread through all six of these stories about these miraculous meals is that the supernatural meal illustrates Jesus' compassion and also his divine nature. But there are other voices, other people, who don't emphasize the supernatural aspect of the story as much. Recently, a comic named Mark Nelson made this totally tweetable joke. I don't know if it actually was on Twitter, but it would fit. Jesus fed 5,000 people with two fishes and a loaf of bread. That's not a miracle. That's tapas. Seriously, though, he's not the first person to wonder if this is a straight-up miracle or if something else is going on here. Almost since the beginning, respectable Christians have observed that, at least in John's telling, there are some other details that point to something else going on here. They wonder, for instance, why would Jesus suddenly be all right creating food when he had refused to do so while tempted in the desert? Okay, good question. Does seem a little inconsistent. Others have pointed out that the 12 baskets were actually rather small. They were just lunch baskets that workers wore on their belts. All right, I guess that's like a little less miraculous. But still, 12 baskets is more than they started out with. And finally, even the word that John uses for sign can mean just that, a symbol that represents something, but is not necessarily a miracle. Even St. Augustine, the 4th century Catholic bishop, who was not exactly a skeptic when it came to the miracles of Jesus, even he got a little frustrated by people who needed the meal to be supernatural, as if God's daily provision isn't impressive enough. So taking all that into account, maybe it's plausible that Jesus wasn't just multiplying the loaves. But if that is true, then what happened? Here's a possible scenario. The boy overhears Philip and Jesus, and as young people often are, he is moved with compassion for those around him. And as many people did at the time, like I said, he has a belt, a basket on his belt with his lunch. And so powered by a simple faith and confidence that Jesus can make something happen, he brings his lunch basket to Andrew, and Andrew brings him to Jesus. The others see this happen, and they're moved by the boy's generosity and by Jesus' blessing. And they open up their own lunch baskets that they've been hoarding this whole time. Some have a little, others have a lot, and they all share. And when all's said and done, there is enough left over for each of the disciples to take for the next day. Do you guys buy that? Some of you do, some of you don't. That's okay. Let me ask you this. When you stop to think about it, what is more impressive, that Jesus produces bread out of thin air? I'm not saying that he couldn't, but what's more impressive, that Jesus produces bread out of thin air, or that faith in Jesus inspires 5,000 people to share? What's harder to do? Magic bread, 5,000 people sharing. They both seem pretty implausible to me. So it's possible, just possible, that the story is not about a miracle on the atomic level in which bread is produced contrary to the laws of physics, but is instead about a miracle of the heart in which bread is shared contrary to the laws of self-interest. Because here's something that I know is true. Jesus doesn't invite us to a magic show. He invites us to a movement. He invites us into a community of resistance that rejects the selfish, violent ways of the world. He invites us to be generous with each other, to reject the mindset of scarcity, the idea that there is not enough to go around, so we had better hold on to what we have. and to embrace instead the mindset of abundance, that what is needed has already been provided by God. The 20th century Christian mystic, Evelyn Underhill, I think summarizes the meaning of the story this way. She says, "Give without reserve, and you will gather up enough to fill your own lunch basket." All right, so probably by now you've realized this is a stewardship sermon. Full disclosure. We are, after all, in the second week of our pledge campaign for 2016. Like I said before, last week we released our narrative budget, and Jeff announced that our goal is to receive $200,000 worth of pledges by November 15th, which is a few weeks away. Since then, some of you have asked, well, what happens if we don't reach that goal? What will that mean for Jeff and Mike, or Dylan, or Heidi, or Becky, or Jen? Maggie, you're safe because the Presbytery pays for your internship, so you're set. But what about the table, or the homeless ministry, or the children's ministry? These are questions people have had. And first, let me just say how much I appreciate the concern that's been expressed, like how much it means to know how much you care for the staff of Hot Metal. And even more than that, how much you care for the mission of our church, which is the most important thing, and how much you want that mission to continue on as it is. But I wonder if maybe the questions behind the questions are this. A concern that, is everyone really going to open up their lunch basket? And even if they do, is it going to be enough? So first, I just want to acknowledge from the start what a brave thing it is to do to open up your lunch basket, especially when you are wondering, maybe as the young boy might have been, do I have enough to spare? Is what I am able to give enough to make a difference? Would anyone even notice if I kept it to myself? And John's gospel, I think, has given us the answer. Alone, it's not enough. But together, it is enough. Jesus makes it actually more than enough. You may also be wondering, possibly, whether the pastors are going to open up our lunch baskets. And to answer your question, yes, we do give. My family gives because we believe in the work that Jeff and Jen and Heidi and Dylan and Becky and Maggie do for our community. We want to help pay for the mortgage and the utilities and the programs like the table and the children's ministry because we believe that what happens here is really good. We believe that the work that you all do, your participation in this community, is really good. And we believe that the world needs a community like ours. And we're just grateful to be a part of it. And grateful to be a part of it. If I could just tell you a couple short stories, things that happened recently that really reinforced this conviction for me, and then we'll wrap up. A couple of weeks ago, we were signing up cooks for our Sunday lunches. As you know, there's a number of people who give a lot of time and energy to preparing food for us to share together as a community on Sundays. And there was one open date left. And the folks who took it are a group of guys who live here in the South Side in a camp. They are currently experiencing homelessness. And one of them is our friend Stretch, who said that Hot Metal had given a lot, and he wanted to contribute something too. And so those of you who are here know they made chichi for everyone, which I think Zach described as prison food. Stretch called it hobo spaghetti. I called it delicious, because it was delicious. But here's what I liked most about it. It showed me that, this is hard to talk about, but there's no us and them when it comes to our church and the homeless community. The people who are homeless are not people that the rest of us do ministry to. We are all in this together. We all come to this community with certain needs, And we all come to this community with something to give. Everyone has something to contribute. And that's really valuable to me. I feel like that's really worthy of support. And I'm glad that that our children, Finn and Violet, will be growing up in this community. Here's the other reason. Last Sunday, we collected pledges from the leadership teams and a few other people who were inspired to pledge. And most of those pledges were written on the narrative budget, on the pledge form at the bottom of the sheet. But one of them was written on a receipt from Aldi for coffee creamer and sweetener. And it was paid for with food stamps. And a note on the receipt promised to bring the same every week. That was this person's pledge. And I know this person would not want to be lifted up as an example. But if you're here, you know who you are. This person opened up their lunch basket, and it was enough. It was more than enough. So as we continue over the next few weeks to consider our pledges to this ministry and to this community, let's not have the mindset of scarcity, worrying whether there will be enough and whether we can continue on as we have been. Let's have a mindset of abundance and dream about what new opportunities we will have to grow as a community when we walk out of the year 2016 with 12 baskets extra. Amen? There's a few more words today from John's gospel for us as we transition into communion time. This is from the same chapter. Later on, Jesus is explaining the significance of the meal. And the people say to him, it's either the crowd or the disciples, someone who doesn't know what's going on. They said to him, "What sign are you going to give us then so that we may see it and believe you? What work are you performing? Our ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness, as it is written. He gave them bread from heaven to eat." Then Jesus said to them, "Very truly, I tell you, it was not Moses who gave you the bread from heaven, but it is my Father who gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is that which comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." They said to him, "Sir, give us this bread always." Jesus said to them, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never be hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty." Amen.